Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Football Weekly, on the road to South Africa. England, bag win, pay price for it. Comparisons with Terry's mum, unwise, say Guardian lawyers. Elsewhere, Ireland, Bulgaria, Traps Republic can't get past Ivankov at home. Comparisons with Jackie Smith's husband, unwise, say Guardian lawyers. Scotland failed to pace the Dutchies. Wales get caught by the Finns. And we salute Northern Ireland, who beat their Poles to come on top of their group. Comparisons with Jackie Smith's husband, etc. There's more. Paul Doyle on a tragic weekend in Africa. Sid Lowe on Spain. And Jonathan Wilson on everything. As we look forward to the midweek matches on the road to South Africa. All that plus your post in today's Football Weekly. Right, welcome on board today, Barney Roney.
Hello.
With a mouthful of, Barney?
Apple, thank you.
Lovely. Healthy option, good news. Paul Doyle, welcome back, Paul.
Hi, James.
Hi, where have you been?
Nowhere in particular.
All right, okay. Oh, excellent. And the large tank containing the pulsing outsized brain of Jonathan Wilson.
Hello.
Hi, Jonathan. How many games did you watch this week, Kend?
Probably bits of about 15.
Really?
It was great.
Was it?
Well, I hate international weeks because nothing happens until the Saturday. But once you hit the Saturday, that's just sensational.
It's all. And how did you manage illegal streaming? Is it? We're all men here. Excellent. What was your favourite game then out of all of those 15 bits?
I was fascinated by the Argentina game. I was really looking forward to that one, and I think the 4-0 win actually. I mean, they fully deserved the 4-0 win, the balance of play, but I think it's. They weren't entirely convincing in that.
Right, okay. If I was going to have a schoolboy discussion on that, who's the best team in the world, would it be Argentina right now?
No.
Who would it be?
Spain, probably still.
Really? Okay.
I think Argentina is potentially the best team in the world, but I don't think that 3-4-3 shape will work against a better team in Venezuela.
Right. Good to get confirmation of my earlier suspicions on that very subject. Some people are very excited, producer Pete's very excited about Bosnia. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about their victory in Belgium later on. Maybe, but there's no question, is there, Barney, that the top story on this Monday here in near Earth orbit is England and their exciting friendly amid the general hubbub of Wembley over Slovakia. So much of interest here, Barney.
Well, it's interesting in that they've got a proper game on Wednesday.
Right.
And I suppose it was a preparation for that. I mean, they won't get to play Slovakia every week, which is obviously a shame for them. They've got a problem with strikers now.
Yes.
Heskey won't make it.
Right.
Do we know if the other two will make it?
I think there's still suspicions that...
Carlton Cole is out, isn't it?
Cole won't, but Crouch is possible.
Still in the mix.
Yes.
I mean, it's sort of interesting, isn't it? England have a striker crisis when Cole and Crouch potentially out. I mean, you sort of wonder whether the cupboard might be a little bit bare.
Mm. Well, it does seem that way. And just to reiterate the big point in the papers, Michael Owen, no question of him being called up.
He's probably not the kind of player they want, is he? I mean, Emil Heskey is obviously the best in the world at playing the Emil Heskey role, but you want someone who kind of resembles a large block of wood,
right,
or something to distract attention so that Rooney can play. That seems to be the role they want.
I did see Bobby Zamora mentioned for a possible understudy role there.
But I'm not sure.
Well, Kevin Davis would surely be closer than Bobby Zamora, no? I think Carlton Cole is better than Heskey at the Heskey role now.
But he's not playing more of a Carlton Cole role. But I mean, Heskey's fantastic. Don't forget how good Heskey was in Croatia. He was absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think he's a great player for England now. He seems very confident.
Yeah, I meant that as praise for Cole rather than slagging off Heskey.
Did Heskey well score by accident on Saturday?
It was a brilliant finish, wasn't it? He was looking the
did
wrong.
He
did him with the eyes. He was looking the other way.
Right.
And it was genius.
All right. Well,
it was an own goal.
Another big win for England. But
they did solve it. Well, they do have problems up front. Their other problem position seemed to move closer to resolution with Glenn Johnson's fine performance at right back. He's looking very accomplished there.
Huh. Good. Well, he's a fine player, Jonathan.
Is anybody else baffled by the whole fuss about Michael Owen? I mean, he's somebody who was out for 7 weeks with an ankle problem and then has played two games that he hasn't completed. Mm. Why on earth would you bring him into the squad? I mean, quite apart from the whole tactical issue that England have found a shape that works with a Heskey style player up front. And Owen is clearly not that. But he's just not fit.
Lazy journalism.
Well, it's just an Owen obsession. It's an obsession with goals.
It's an obsession with celebrity players. He is a celebrity player, and we can't get over that. I mean, what David Beckham? I mean, I suppose he's...
No, you had to go and mention that, didn't you, Barney?
Substitute.
Right. Well, I've got another question, and that is that after the Spain defeat, put everything a little bit in perspective. There is always a suspicion that, fine results notwithstanding, England are just one decent team away from being cut down to size again. Are Ukraine this Wednesday that decent team?
I think Ukraine have problems of their own. I mean, they're a decent side. They got a draw at home against Croatia. They held them relatively comfortably to 0-0, so defensively they are very good. The problem they have is it's almost a bit like the Beckham situation, that they have an old man at Milan who doesn't play at the high level often enough, and he keeps getting picked for the national team, and his form for the national team is okay. Against Croatia, he possibly looked a bit off the pace, and I think they're going to try and fit Shevchenko into the team, but Voronin scored 7-7 for Hertha, and so they will pick him as well.
Voronin, Mr. Danger. Yeah, no, that's what I was going to say. Andrew Voronin, that was my note there, Hertha Berlin.
Yeah, but so I think Mikhailchenko would rather play one up, and he's now going to have to play, he'd probably play Shevchenko off Voronin, but that means Aliyev has been very good. Instead of playing in the central playmaking role, having to move to the left. And that's why I think Aaron Lennon's going to be vital for England. I think it's a shame Walcott isn't there, because we saw the problems Walcott caused against Croatia when Pranjic, a Croatian left-back, couldn't get forward to support the attack. And they have Rakitic, Croatia had Rakitic on the left who drifts inside, which can be a similar thing, that Aliyev's always going to be drifting inside. Shevchuk, the Ukrainian left-back, will be looking to get forward to kind of cover that flank. So if you're playing something with pace high up on the right-hand side, that's going to really disrupt that. So I think Lennon's got a vital role on Wednesday.
Oh, fantastic. Anything else we should know about the Ukrainian team?
No.
Paul?
That's what I was going to say.
All right. Roger Palmer posting in saying he's a bit concerned in general that England still haven't settled on a formation or a starting lineup. Is that something that we should be concerned about at this stage?
I don't think that's necessarily true, is it? No. They seem to be playing 4-4-2 with a Rooney in a withdrawn striker role.
Well, they did on Saturday.
Yeah, but they seem to have... They've played that for the last few games. That's what Capello wants to do, it seems.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of 4-4-2 edging towards 4-3-3-1, isn't it? It has that the advantage that Rooney can pull left, which he does for Manchester United, and Gerrard cuts inside, which suits him, and I think that interchange works very well.
Excellent. Right, Northern Ireland. Congratulations, Eb. Obviously, there was a lot of talk on the post last week about Barry's comments about the Windsor Park atmosphere, etc. And a lot of people replying that there was an outdated idea, and that Northern Ireland's fans have been voted or named as world's best by FIFA or some such. There was trouble. Where it started and who's to blame for it is an issue I don't think we need to necessarily get into here, apart from obviously condemning that and the bloke who threw whatever it was at the assistant referee. However, congratulations to Northern Ireland, who are now on top of their group. They've played more games than anyone else in the group, though. But could they be heading to a majors finals for the first time since 1986?
The odds have to be heavily against it, but I mean, they always are. They did. They were top of their group in World Cup qualification at one stage last season as well. I mean, they're obviously punching well above their weight, as is their tradition, and they've played. Not only have they played more games than anyone else, that I think they've played easier games than most people. They've played San Marino twice, for example. That's accounted for two of their victories, and they still have to go to. Away to the heavyweights in that group. I'm not saying anything that isn't obvious. They're up against it, and but they can do it. They revel in being the underdogs who punch above their weight.
It's been a stirring comeback as well, because they had a rubbish start. And it's not been done with David Healy's goals, is the big shot. Slovenia at home, big test.
That is a vital game in that group. I mean, Slovenia... they're only, 2 points behind, played a game fewer. And Slovenia's advantage is they've played both their games against the Czechs already.
Ooh.
Now, I think Slovenia are pretty average going forward and pretty well organised at the back.
Right.
They've got, a bit like Northern Ireland, they've got the advantage that the home ground in Maribor is small and a very kind of fiery, intense atmosphere. It's difficult for teams to go there and get a result. Whether they're that good on the road, we'll see a bit more clearly on Wednesday.
Right. Well, continuing our tour of the UK and Ireland teams, Scotland were off in Amsterdam taking on Netherlands.
I watched this game on television after the England game, and I was just interested in four teams involved in those two games, and only one of them's been to a tournament in the last, since 2006. And you could really see that Holland just looked like a much more relaxed, comfortable team. And I'm not sure it's a great Holland team, but... they just played very well, and they looked like they knew they were going to win. They knew what they had to do. And, Scotland, I see before the game, George Birdie said, football's not all about skill. It's also about things like heart and commitment and bravery. And I just found that very depressing and old-fashioned, as though Holland are not going to have heart and bravery because they've got skill. And that, I just thought it's not really the way forward.
And it's the other way around, isn't it? Scotland don't actually have anything else apart from heart and bravery.
And yeah, maybe on this occasion. And especially because, you know, traditionally, Scottish football, you think it was skillful football. Scotland used to, I mean, playing the Scottish way used to be the same as playing the Dutch way. But obviously that's a long time
ago. Those days over. Incidentally, guided by Bugnish, commenting on Raphael's suggestion last week that Bert van Marwijk is unpopular in Holland. He says, no, the Dutch public are generally pleased to have a manager that's a little bit more predictable, reliable and diplomatic than Van Basten was. Speaking of a predictable, reliable and diplomatic, Craig Bellamy in fine form after Wales' defeat at home by the exciting Finland. Barney, I know you were enjoying this, presumably with the aid of goggle eyes posted by your two-year-old son. You didn't really need them because Craig was doing that all by himself.
His eyes were... It was just sort of an amazing thing, wasn't it? You're not sure whether this is really refreshing. It's a footballer saying the sort of things he probably says to his mates in the dressing room, or whether it's just completely unacceptable to say that about your team and about your teammates, and also about the other team.
What did he say, Barney?
Well, he said they weren't good enough to beat us. They shouldn't have beaten us. He said Jonathan Johansson wasn't good enough to score a goal against Wales, even though Johansson has 19 international goals, which is not bad going.
And better than Craig Bellamy?
Possibly.
Yep.
And it was just really disrespectful, not just to the other team, but to his own team.
Yeah, he just cast off Wales and kind of stared morosely at the interviewer and said, where do we go next?
But it was oddly refreshing as well to hear someone not trotting out the platitudes.
Well, that's true. Do Wales need to move stadium urgently?
What, to one closer to some actual fans who might
go?
Yeah, maybe they could do an MK Dons, go and play in South America somewhere.
Right, but no, but I mean, you've got the Liberty Ground, is it? Liberty Stadium, the new Swansea's new place.
Is the stadium the problem?
I think, I mean, it's not the biggest problem in Welsh football, but I don't think it helps when you have 50,000 empty seats. I think you see that, you know, even domestically, you look at somebody like Millwall, who never fill their ground. You go there, it just feels very flat, it feels very empty. Sunderland, when they were in the Championship getting, you know, high 20,000s in a 48,000 capacity stadium, it just doesn't feel kind of like a big game, and I think that kind of can be a problem. Yeah,
right. They could always cut ticket prices.
Another fine suggestion there. Germany are arriving on Wednesday. Perhaps that would be a good opportunity to do that. They're arriving from a 4-0 win over Liechtenstein, but there's not really too much we can say about that, I imagine. No, indeed not. Excellent. The other team proximate to the British Isles, but not a home nation thereof, is of course the Republic of Ireland, who had a disappointing 1-1 draw with Bulgaria. Next up, they face Italy. All sorts to talk about that. We'll be doing so right after this. Guardian.co.uk/football is the place to get all the latest news and most informed comment about the world of football. Now, next up here on the pod, we're going to be talking about Ireland, who are off in Bari on Wednesday, facing group leaders Italy. Big matches, obviously, for Giovanni Trapattoni, who's received a bit of criticism, I imagine, Paul. He certainly seemed to be upset in his press conference yesterday, post the 1-1 draw with Bulgaria.
Yeah, I mean, when he goes to Italy, nothing is surer than he will go for a 0-0 draw. And the criticism that he's now copping is because he seems to set out for a 0-0 draw in every match. He got off to a great start against Bulgaria at the weekend, and there was a lot of excitement ahead of
him. Wasn't that the worst possible start with Trapattoni at the helm, actually scoring a goal? Because then you know he's just going to sit and defend it for 89 minutes.
well, he would have done that anyway. Yeah. That's what they've done. And it was better than previous starts when they've conceded in the first minute. So it was an improvement in that regard. But the thing is, he sits back and he does not have the players in central midfield to keep possession. So it's one thing trying to be negative and stop the other team from scoring, but the best way to do that is to hold on to the ball yourself. Mm. But we don't have the players in central midfield to do that. Which Andy Reid is the most obvious absentee. He's no genius, and he has been inconsistent for Ireland when he's played under previous managers, but he is the best at retaining possession and picking out a pass and forming a kind of linkage between the various sectors of the game, which is a problem at the moment. And Trapattoni has cast him into exile. It makes you wonder whether if Stephen Ireland did decide to make himself available again, would Trapattoni even pick him? I don't know. I mean, we're still in a, still well placed in the group, and his method may well be vindicated if we scrape through. In second place seems the most likely.
You're 7 points clear of Bulgaria, which is what Trapattoni was pointed to as the big positive.
That's true. Again, the fixture list has to be taken into account. Bulgaria have drawn all four games, but three of them have been away, and the home one was against Italy. Ireland haven't faced Italy yet,
right,
and have to go to Bulgaria. Bulgaria's next three games are all at home, all very winnable, and they could, you know, bridge that gap fairly rapidly. They were technically a far more accomplished team than Ireland were on Saturday. They didn't create that many opportunities, and Trapattoni could say that had Ireland taken some of the chances that they did create in their hurly-burly anarchic kind of way, then his method could have been justified. Italy did win in Podgorica, and Ireland could have won there earlier in the group. They drew 0-0 there, and that, I think, could prove to be a more costly draw than the one on Saturday, because that was one when Ireland were manifestly superior to Montenegro. But as the game opened up a little bit in the second half, and it looked like Ireland would benefit from that openness, Trapattoni closed it and said, no, we'll take the 0-0.
He's agoraphobic, isn't he?
Yes.
Yes. Italy, a fine 2-0 win in Montenegro. Not that amazing a scoreline, but the Italian papers are very, very happy with this, because not only was it a victory that opened up a 2-point lead over Ireland at the top of that group, but it also kind of unveiled the new direction. We were talking about, you know, having a settled side and that, and there has been some discussion about how Lippi's new Italy is going to take shape, because they can't keep on relying on the heroes of Berlin. The novelty is the 29-year-old Andrea Pirlo, who's just moved up a little bit. He's now playing behind it's either the front three or front one. And there's one striker, and you've got two wide men out front. And then he's basically just behind off that central striker. And it worked brilliant. He looked absolutely fantastic on Saturday.
Yeah. Another thing that worked in Italy's favour on Saturday was some catastrophic refereeing by English referee Martin Atkinson.
You're referring to the Cannavaro decision.
The Cannavaro, as clear a red card offence as you'll ever see. And he only got a yellow.
Well, indeed. Indeed he did. So he will still be available on Wednesday. And we'll be picking up, I think, is it 123rd or 124th cap, which puts some other record breakers into perspective. And he's still not Italy's record outfield cap winner. That's Paolo Maldini, 126. But Cannavaro set to clinch that probably before the end of the qualifiers. They are playing in Bari. There has the thing to mention about Italy and their... amid all the excitement, the press keep trying to drum up a bit of unrest among the home fans over the fact that Marcello Lippi hasn't called up Antonio Cassano, who is Bari's most famous footballing product, but isn't part of Lippi's plans, and nor do I think will be, because of the way he used to behave when he was with the under-21s. He used to kind of walk out if he wasn't in the starting lineup. He'd basically just walk out of training and that. There you go. Big nation missing out on World Cup. Apparently England are going to let someone else have a turn at this this time around. We thought it might have been France, but then they won in Lithuania, Paul. Is that a significant win or not?
It's a significant win. They're congratulating themselves in much the same way a sort of recovering alcoholic congratulates himself on getting through a Saturday night without drinking. It wasn't a good performance, but at least they were compact and moved the ball around reasonably well.
Right.
Ribery scored with basically their only shot on target, but they didn't concede any chances to the opposition, unlike the last time they went to Lithuania, where only bad finishing by Lithuania spared them. So they won 1-0. If they beat Lithuania in France on Wednesday, then they're right back in contention. And
right.
It's a weak enough group. What are they? Well, Serbia actually are looking fairly menacing.
Well, yeah, they
Jonathan may be able to.
Yeah,
beat Romania. They were very good on. Well, they say they're very good. There's an argument that their third goal might have been offside, but I think on the balance of play, Serbia probably deserved it.
Well, they're five clear, aren't they? Serbia. 5 points clear. France are third with a game in hand.
They're 3 points clear of Lithuania. 5 points clear of France.
Oh, five of France. Right. And
one point I should mention about France is Dominic, it was a capital match for him, and he took a huge decision. He left out Benzema and brought in Peggy Loyendula, who hadn't even been in the original squad and was only called up because of injuries, and it was an extraordinary decision on the face of it. But people say that Benzema has been getting a bit too big for his boots, and this may bring him back into line. So in the long run, may turn out to have been a good decision.
Any word on the former dustman? Is he still part of Dominic's
No, post? And I don't think he's even scored for his club since being called up in November for that friendly. He's in wretched form. Steve Savidon is his name.
Now, how's your apple going there, Bonnie?
It's really good, actually. It's a Brabant, and it's really tasty.
It's the king of apples.
Kind of, it's quite tart.
But it's crisp. It's sharp as well.
Mm, it is sharp.
It is sharp.
Yeah, and I like it though. It's kind of
it's not Granny Smith sharp, because that's kind of cooking apple sharp.
I've never really liked the Granny Smith.
No, neither have I.
There's
something about
the texture as well.
Yeah, I'm a Braeburn man, definitely.
Mm. Right. I'm amazed that people still stock other, you know, your Fujis and your stuff. I'm amazed that people still stock that kind of stuff.
Did you know the jazz apple is an invention?
You just made it up now.
No, the jazz is...
It's a popular apple, but it was just invented.
Especially with the Home Secretary's husband. Anyway, off we go. Listen, if France are going to make it to South Africa, what about Portugal? Could Cristiano Ronaldo fail to grace our screens come next summer? Hmm? No? You're looking for your notes. They're third, Jonathan, behind Hungary and Denmark. 4 points. Behind Hungary and Denmark, who are tied atop the group, and they drew 0-0 with a understrength Sweden at home on Saturday.
It's not the strongest group, is it? If you look at who they've got, they're going to play Hungary twice, and Denmark. I think Sweden and Portugal will get out of that group.
You reckon?
Yeah.
Do you think there's going to be a big name that doesn't go along? Brazil, maybe.
Brazil often stutter, don't they, in qualification, but then they end up winning the last four games and getting there. I think they have a very long qualification period, don't they? And players all over the world, so in the end they kind of pull it together.
It was shocking last night. I mean, how they got a draw out of that game was...
Shall we talk about South America now, shall we?
If you like.
Good, do. Yeah, go on then. Tell us about the Ecuador match. I mean, it was played in Ecuador.
Yeah,
Quito.
But, I mean, I know that... I don't think it wasn't Quito, actually. I think it was somewhere else in Ecuador.
Oh, was it?
Unless the word I saw was name of the stadium rather than the city. Anyway, it was played at altitude.
Yeah.
And I know that can kind of takes a toll, but surely you have to prepare for that. And if Brazil haven't prepared for that, that's their fault.
Well, it's difficult when, as Barney says, your players all play around the world.
I still take them. You can still take them there 3 or 4 days before the game. You can still kind of, you know, you can put them in chambers and things to get them used to it. But I mean, that doesn't excuse not closing down. Doesn't excuse the gaps that appear in the defence. Doesn't excuse the kind of just chaos.
It's interesting because the last time they played there in World Cup qualifying, I remember that they actually turned up on the morning of the game as their way of basically trying to avoid the effects of, I don't know if you call it altitude sickness, but that kind of oxygen deficiency, and then gave players injections to try and get through it, I think. But they have an awful record away to Ecuador, is it? I'm not sure if the goal they scored yesterday, Julio Baptista scored, was that the first goal they've ever scored there in World Cup qualifying?
I don't know, that may be true, yeah.
Maybe. If that's true, can you leave it in pretty soon, Pete?
What sort of injections did they give to
combat?
A downer of some sort?
Yeah, well, I know when I climbed Kilimanjaro a year gone last summer, before it was the kind of trendy celebrity thing to do.
Right.
when it was
cool. It's probably what made it the trendy celebrity thing to do.
Is it climbing, or do you just walk, basically?
It's very easy. I mean, technically, it's very easy.
You walked up Kilimanjaro, then?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, I climbed Triglav in Slovenia 2 years before that, which is much, much harder.
Was that actually
As producer Pete did, I found out earlier today, actually. We both climbed Triglav.
Wow, you guys are proper... Yeah, snow and rock type.
Well, no, it's not, I mean, Triglav's not that hard technically, but it's a lot harder than Kilimanjaro.
Okay.
We seem to have drifted off a point. What was the question?
Injections.
Oh, yeah.
And there's something you can, I don't know if maybe it's an anti-malarial pill or something that's meant to kind of protect you against altitude sickness.
Right.
So there is stuff you can take.
All right, well, Brazil, that's probably about their sixth draw in their last 11, I believe, isn't it?
But, I mean, they only got a draw because I know they conceded the last-minute equaliser, but, you know, on the balance of the game, it's only Julio Cesar, the goalkeeper, who kind of got them. I mean, he made 4 or 5 really good saves. And I noticed last night, I kind of, during when he played for Inter against United, I was thinking he reminded me of somebody. I realised who it was last night. You know, in The Office, the bloke who sacks... David Brent.
Oh, yeah.
Looks very like him, I think.
He's got a big break in Hollywood, that bloke, hasn't he? The bloke who sacks David Brent. He was in The International.
Oh, was he?
He played a kind of bent lawyer who gets killed.
How appropriate, because Internationals is exactly what I was trying to discuss here. And
and to kind of link it back in as well.
Oh, yeah.
Dave Brent famously complains there on this, the Day of Laughter, because he gets sacked on Comic Relief Day.
Yes.
Wednesday is April Fool's Day, which I found out this week in Ukraine. It's called the International Day of Laughter.
Is that so? Mm. Is that so? Who'll have the last laugh at Wembley? Well, we'll be discussing that on Thursday. But in the meantime, now, you were watching South American qualifying last night, and we did have rumbles for Paige. Somebody who wanted us to... There you go. Kayaking says, can we have a mention of Chile, who are doing very well? They're now third after their 3-1 win over Peru, keyed by Alexis Sanchez of Udinese. As Kayaking points out, Uruguay beat leaders Paraguay, their first win in 4, which keeps them nicely placed in their habitual fifth-placed playoff spot. But Argentina, meanwhile... have moved up into second place, Jonathan.
Yeah, and they were good in patches against Venezuela. I mean, if you see the goals, they are lovely goals.
Yeah.
And Messi was fantastic, and Aguero, after the quiet first half, came in the second half. Tevez played very well. But that 3-4-3 shape, I think, is of use against a team like Venezuela, who have very little attacking ambition. It's a way of getting players forward, of swamping them, which is what happened. But I'd be very concerned about that against a better side. So I'll be interested to see what happens against Bolivia on Wednesday, whether Maradona goes in with the same shape. I mean, you just look at that side and you think it's just set up to be a 4-2-3-1. They've got a load of good holding players that they've got. I mean, I don't think he'd rate Gago, but Gago's obviously playing for Real Madrid, clearly is a good player. Mascherano, arguably the best in that role in the world. Then people like Battaglia or Cambiasso who could play there. So they've got holding midfielders to play the two there. Those three who they played up front, Aguero, Tevez and Messi, you could see them in a three behind a front man. But then the issue is, who's that front man? Mm. It's very hard to see any. I mean,
Franco Di Santo is who they want in.
What they need is Emil Heskey.
Yeah.
If only you were fit and Argentinian.
Right. Very interesting. So, but that slight issue notwithstanding, Bolivia, there's the issue of altitude, 3,600 metres up.
Yeah, and the fascinating thing there is, of course, Maradona was very vociferous.
I thought you were going to say he was used to getting high or something.
No, you've mistaken me with Sean Engel. when FIFA tried to stop people like Bolivia and Colombia playing at Ecuador playing at altitude,
right,
Maradona was very outspoken in saying, no, they have to be allowed to do this because they are their capital cities. And now, he's having to face that.
Right. Oh, that's interesting, because we were discussing this before, the fact that in the last round of qualifiers, there had been this ban on, I can't remember, was anything above 2,000 metres or something?
Something like that, yeah.
It was a brief ban, wasn't it?
Yeah, and Maradona was very kind of vocal against that.
Right. Oh, well, good for him. Good for him. If you want to get in touch with us here on the pod, the address is guardian.co.uk/footballweekly, or there's our Facebook page. Let's see, there was a bundle of posts this last week. One or two of them, V. Sinical, referring to us talking about Raphael Schite and asking, consequently, what was the single most incomprehensible transfer decision your club has ever made? Wonk chips in with Winston Bogard, which probably is right up there. Jamoski, the 10 million that Chelsea chucked away on Chris Sutton, that wasn't that remarkable. On the Rude Names 11, the one that refuses to go away, Alan Rees for England says, has Brian Penis been mentioned yet? Discovered by Newcastle, only to never make an appearance. I can't even be bothered to come up with a pun for this one. Sid Cajones says, Brian Penis, was he hard? Ricardo 67 contradicts Barry Glendenning, as is the custom. Says Celtic didn't actually have Weir to combine with Tebbley and Shite, but were linked with Rod Fanny of Rennes a couple of years ago, who would have struck up a fine partnership with Bobo Baldi. It would have been just like watching a Brazilian, he suggests. Yeah. That's clever. Right, okay. And then you got James Hill and Hassan Kashlul mentioning Charlton's comedy backline, which famously was Young Fish Cost a Fortune. Australians. Lots of upset Australians. Again, after Barry's... how can I put this? Negative comments about their World Cup prospects. And offering bets. Gunner Who wants to bet that England... Australia lift the World Cup before England, Scotland or Ireland do. And Barry actually accepted Case 1175's fiver that Australia will go further than England in 2010. So it'll be interesting to see how that one turns out. A fiver is on that one. That's enough post for now. And that's indeed enough part two for now. Still to come, we have Sid Lowe in Spain and Paul Dore, not in Africa, but quite literally on Africa. Not literally on Africa, actually, because that, but all that in a second. Hey ho, it's Sid Lowe in Spain.
Hello.
Hi, Sid, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are
Excellent.
You?
Have you got your house back to yourself? Have the Ingles gone?
Yeah, they've gone, yes, they've gone, yeah.
All right, okay. Now, Spain were hosting some interesting guests midweek, the Turks. It wasn't the expected turkey shoot, though, was it?
No, and Spain were, I think, probably as unimpressed as they've been since before the European Championships. Turkey really put pressure on them. They made it very difficult for them. And Spain won 1-0 with what was essentially a pretty scrappy goal, a set play that kind of dropped to Sergio Ramos. It bounced off his knee and then fell to Gerard Piqué to score. It's only the first time he's played a competitive game for Spain. Obviously, his first game was against England back in Seville. And Spain won it 1-0 with a kind of scrappy goal from a set play. But what that has done, I think, to some extent, is it's enabled people in Spain to say, wow, we really are good, aren't we? We can even win when we don't play well. And obviously, they're very, very happy about that.
Excellent. They're in Turkey, facing the Turks again on Wednesday. Doesn't really matter, though, even if they lose. Is that right? They're basically through.
Well, it doesn't really. I mean, the Turks are talking about revenge and they're saying that, you know, we're gonna get the result that we should have got in Madrid. But in truth, it doesn't matter enormously for the Spanish. They've now won 5 out of 5, 15 points. Unless I'm much mistaken, I think the Turks are on 8 points, so they've got a 7-point lead over Turkey. And obviously, only one team goes through automatically, the others go to a playoff. But I think Spain are now in a very, very strong position. So much so that looking at the way the fixtures fall between now and the end of the campaign, you think that just winning the home games will be enough for Spain to top the group.
Yeah, Bosnia, who we were talking about, their victory over Belgium, in second place there on 9 points, a full 6 behind Spain, having played the same number of games. So you can understand the Spanish taking their foot off the gas a little bit as they roar through this qualifying group. Sid, what else is new? You've got Real Madrid members having their assembly yesterday. They've elected Baluda, your chum there, as president.
Yeah, what's essentially happened, obviously, the assembly under Ramon Calderon was a disaster, of course. There was lots of shouting. There were suggestions that he'd sneak people in. That was essentially what provoked the situation in which Marca went for him and he was forced to step down as president. But Luda has been ratified as president now. Although, of course, he's saying that he's only going to stay until the summer. Elections are on the 14th of June at the very latest. Now, this has been received, he was ratified yesterday. It's been received as a real triumph for Real Madrid as a club, because if he hadn't been ratified, there could have been a colossal institutional kind of crisis, because they'd have been officially presidentless. Then it's not been clear exactly what would have then happened from there on in. But there's one big change, of course, which is really, really important, is that the system of voting for postal votes in elections has been changed. Now, last elections, it was postal votes that were fraudulent and of course all the problems. So it looks like we might actually have a relatively clean election campaign in the summer.
And you're confident that Florentino Perez is going to be the winner?
Absolutely confident. I mean, yesterday in a way actually confirmed that even more so, because Baluda is clearly talking to Perez behind the scenes. Perez, the one thing he didn't want actually was a change in the postal votes. This time he's got it. And that's not what he wanted, but I think he's going to be so popular that he'll win anyway. And one of the interesting things, I think, in all of this, perhaps to lay down here, is that while we've hammered Ramon Calderon for various of the things that he did wrong, essentially the measures and the changes that were pushed through comfortably yesterday in the Assembly were the same measures that he tried to push through in the Assembly during the year and wasn't able to, just because no one trusts him.
Hmm. Sid, there's been various comments that when Perez comes back in, if indeed he does, he'll be arriving with a war chest of £300 million to spend on the world's best players. Is that in any way related to the truth, that suggestion, or what?
Well, it's not related to
the truth. Is there some sound effect?
You want a plane, Sid? Have you just opened the window?
No, I don't think so.
There was a kind of Darth Vader hissing style.
Oh, that was me. That was me sighing. Because it's related to the truth in so much as Florentino Perez, or rather, Florentino Perez himself is saying absolutely nothing. It's very, very interesting. It's being handled on his behalf by the media. It's very clear that the players he's after, if he's going to get them all, then we are talking about €300 million. But it's not related to a truth in so much as there isn't a hard and fast figure that says that this is what he's going to spend. Also, Real Madrid are in debt, so theoretically couldn't spend it, but of course they always find a way of doing so. So it's related to truth in so much as he will be very ambitious with his attempts to buy players. But there's not actually a kind of, if you like, a specific figure there that says, right, €300 million, let's go and spend it.
No. Who's he after, Sid? Is it the usual names, the Ronaldo?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously Cristiano Ronaldo is a typical name, and Ramon Calderon brilliantly said a couple of weeks ago, I've already got a deal for Cristiano Ronaldo, which was his way of saying, if it doesn't come off, then the other guys are rubbish. If it does come off, then I'm the one that you should all thank, even though, of course, he was a clown who didn't manage to get him the last two times he tried to get him. So Cristiano Ronaldo is very high on the list. Other figures that are very high on the list, in particular this weekend, Cesc Fabregas, who was very, very non-committal in some things he said in an event in his hometown of Rennes de Mar over the course of the weekend. He was wearing a white jacket and he was asked why he was wearing white, and he said with a wink and a nudge, he said, well, white really suits me. There's a real feeling that Fabregas may well be paving the way for an exit from Arsenal.
Wait, did he play for England? Is it?
Yeah, that's the one, exactly. Yeah, he wants to play for England now. Yeah.
Was it a white leather jacket?
Was it leather? I must say, I've only seen photographs and I can't actually make out what material it's actually made of.
Well, very good, Sid. Thank you very much for that. Look forward to your comments on Thursday, if we can get hold of you then.
Speak to you then.
Good Thanks, stuff. Sid.
Cheers.
Sid Lowe in Spain. Now, Ars Technica says, please get Paul Doyle to talk about World Cup qualifications for the Africa region. This was it's the second stage, Paul, am I right, of the World Cup qualifiers, and it's the first games in that second stage.
It's the third stage.
Third stage. Right,
and third and last stage.
Right, okay.
Five groups, and the winner of each group will go to the World Cup.
Right, okay, cool. And we've just had the first games, but everything's been a bit overshadowed by the tragic events in Ivory Coast.
That's right. Ahead of the match between Ivory Coast and Malawi, Didier Drogba went on TV on Friday night to call for fans to turn out en masse. And they did, and rather too many of them were allowed into the ground. Suggestions maybe that some policemen accepted bribes to let people without tickets in. And the stadium, which has only recently been refurbished just earlier this year to host the inaugural African Football Championship, and therefore should have been in good nick, couldn't withstand the volume of people, and a wall collapsed and 19 people died. This was all before the game, and a bit like in the Heysel Stadium all those years ago, the authorities decided the best thing to do would be to press ahead and play the match for fear of not playing it leading to greater riots. So those investigations are obviously ongoing into exactly who's to blame for all of this. The match went ahead and Ivory Coast won 5-0. So they were one of the few big guns to get off to a good start in Africa, where there were shocks all around. Egypt drew at home to Zambia, and back-to-back African Nations Cup winning manager Hassan Shehata has actually was criticised for the first time in 4 years. He had a full squad, no injuries, although Amr Zaki did pick up an injury later in the game, and much to Steve Bruce's anger, I imagine, had to play on because they'd made all three substitutions. So he's out for a month possibly now, so that'll hit their European campaign. But they drew 1-1 with Zambia, and Shehata changed his formation. He has this curious thing where he's always played 3-5-2 in competitive matches and always played 4-4-2 in friendlies for some reason. And on Saturday he played 4-4-2.
Did he just get mixed up, do you think?
Well, no, I think because in the last competitive match against Zambia, actually, they drew 1-1. And so that he was hoping to get a better result. He didn't, so they drew 1-1. At least that was only a draw, though. Cameroon were beaten, technically away to Togo, although because of the Togo stadium isn't up to scratch, the match had to be played on neutral territory. And Reading's Andre Bike made a terrible mistake and allowed Adebayor to score.
Right.
Samuel Eto'o is coming under an intense... That actually was interesting for a lot of reasons, because Togo's manager is Jean Tissène, who went for the Cameroon job, and Pfister got it instead. Mm. And Pfister was criticised for some of his selections, mainly leaving out Toulouse's Achille Imana in preference to the likes of Jeremy and Alex Song in midfield. So, and they were outplayed there, apparently. And probably the biggest result was Gabon winning in Morocco. They went there a couple of years ago and lost 6-0. This time under French legend Alain Giresse, who a lot of people will probably remember with affection. They went there and won 2-1, and deservedly so. Although Morocco did hit the bar twice, Gabon had a lot of great opportunities, and Karim Zaza in the Moroccan goal made a lot of saves from one-on-one situations. Correct. And they were very good. So it's all set up nicely. All five groups really are probably going to go down to the wire, because even Nigeria didn't win in Mozambique. They only drew.
You mentioned Cameroon. No, you mentioned Togo Stadium not being up to scratch.
Yeah.
And I mean, this relates to great Barry Sanders posting asking if FIFA do safety checks on stadiums being used for international football, and post the Ivory Coast disaster. He was questioning whether, given that FIFA recently announced they were £625 million in profit, they might be wanting to do a little bit more to help the infrastructure of stadiums in Africa. It is a widespread problem then, huh?
Well, there have been several stadium disasters that have cost lives in Africa this century, and in most cases the common denominator has been bad crowd management and bad policing rather than bad infrastructure. For example, there are suggestions that yesterday when the crowd started to spill onto the pitch, etc., in a bid to escape the crush, the police fired tear gas. Now, that's what happened in Ghana in 2001, where over 100 people were killed. So that hasn't been confirmed yet that it happened in Abidjan. And obviously, if it's true that they were letting more people in than they should have done, that's bad policing. But somebody said to me this morning that this could cast doubt on South Africa's ability to host the World Cup, which is a ludicrous thing to say. It's like saying if there's a bus crash in Poland, we should stop the traffic in Portugal.
Well, I'd kind of heard people saying this. So I actually looked up the distance from Abidjan to Johannesburg, which is 3,060 miles. Yeah. Abidjan to London is 3,200 miles. So if this casts doubt on South Africa hosting the World Cup, then possibly we should pull out of 2018 as well. Yeah.
Excellent. Well, good point. Well made there. Paul, very good. Well, it sounds like there's going to be plenty to talk about. Any big games on Wednesday? Are they playing midweek, the Africans?
No.
All right, okay. Plenty to talk about, but not regarding the African qualifiers. On Thursday, when we will be returning with Football Weekly Extra in time-honoured fashion. In the meantime, many, many thanks, Paul, for your excellent return.
Thank you.
And Barney Roné.
Thank you.
And to Jonathan Wilson.
Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And Ben and Pete at the controls. And we look forward to speaking to you again on Thursday.